Hi, and welcome to Serial Sisters, a podcast where my sister and I tell each other true crime stories. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Devonna.
And this week, Devonna has a story for me.
All right, so this week I had a really hard time picking, but then I found a really good one that I hope you don't know of.
What is it?
So, it's Audrey Marie Frazier.
I don't think so.
She also goes by Audrey Marie Hilly. So chime in anytime if it does sound familiar.
I don't think so.
Okay. So, and it's odd because she's alternately addressed as Audrey and Marie at times during the story. So I'm going to kind of facilitate between those two names.
One of those weirdos that sometimes that goes by her middle name instead.
Yeah. All right. So Audrey Marie Frazier was born on June 4th, 1933 in Blue Mountain, Alabama. Her early life is not very documented, either on Wikipedia or Murderpedia. She married Frank Hilly on May 8, 1951, when she was 18. Marie stayed behind in Anniston to finish high school, where Frank went to Long Beach, California, to finish out his stint.
Where's Anniston again?
Marie, it is in Alabama. So, I hope, anyway. So Marie joined him there after her graduation and later accompanied him when he was reassigned to Boston in 1952. At the end of his tour of duty, they discovered Marie was pregnant, and when he was discharged, they moved back home to Anniston, where they bought a small home. He got a job in the shipping department of Standard Foundry while Marie worked as a secretary. Their first child, a boy, Michael, was born on November 11, 1952. Outwardly, the Hillies seemed happy and settled, but the first stirrings of trouble had already begun. Marie liked to spend money. When Frank had sent home his paychecks from California, Marie had spent them with astonishing speed, and when the time came for her to join him out west, she had no money with which to make
a trip. Bitches be shopping.
So she was burning through that money. So, and, I mean, this is the 50s, so you figure money has a lot of spending power. So her in-laws actually had to pay her way out to meet her husband.
That always looks good.
And these habits didn't stop. And though Frank liked to make Marie happy, he found it hard to keep pace with her constant acquisition of newer and nicer clothes and furnishings. There were arguments, but Frank didn't like to fight and found it easier to just go along with her whims as best as he could rather than to bicker over every purchase. And it does seem like he loved his wife a lot.
Well, yeah, because that's actually, like, fairly progressive for what I imagine is the 50s, where, bitch, get your shit under control and like smack her around. I know that that can't possibly have been like all of the 50s, but...
But it seems to be, like, the prevailing culture of, like, keeping your wife on these tight strings. So, by the time that their daughter, Carol Hilly, was born in 1960, Frank had been appointed foreman of the shipping department at Standard Foundry, and Marie has a reputation as an excellent executive secretary. So, the family's collective income had increased, but it barely kept pace with her spending. So, she was also developing a disturbing work pattern. Though her employers always found her professional and effective at her duties, her co-workers thought otherwise. Marie judged and put on airs and played power games, but was always careful to remain respectful and subservient to
kiss ass.
So she knew how to play the game, right? At each job, she eventually became unpopular with those around her and left, telling friends and family that she'd been ganged up on by her fellow employees. Her references were always excellent, though, and she never had trouble getting another job. She worked for some of the most powerful men in Anniston, all of them who spoke glowingly of her. Later, Frank, her husband, would find out one of the reasons why.
Was she banging her bosses? Okay, sorry.
So Carol and Mike wanted nothing except perhaps their mother's attention. So like her own parents, Marie showered her children with material possessions, but remained emotionally remote.
You see, that never ends well.
She administered little... So she's always like this cold mom. And then she didn't really administer any discipline to the children, leaving that task to Frank's mother, Carrie.
That's just...
Who cared for the children.
That's mean. Grandparents are supposed to be fun.
Right?
That's the whole point of being grandparents is that you're the fun one.
Yeah, I don't want kids, but I want to be a grandma.
That's, I've been saying for years that I'm going to adopt a pregnant 17-year-old. That's been my plan for forever.
Just get it in one go. Oh my goodness. So the kids were left in the care of Frank's mother while they worked. And Marie favored Mike and allowed him to grow into a little hellion, brushing off his behavior with a casual boys will be boys attitude.
Boys will be held responsible for their actions.
And it's crazy things haven't changed that much.
I know, but it still makes me angry.
Crazy angry. So, as for Carol, she seemed always to be missing the mark. Carol was a tomboy, nothing like the demure, proper daughter Marie wanted. They clashed continuously. So, Frank, noticing the effect Marie's treatment was having, took a special interest in Carol, taking her for ice cream into football games. And then their close relationship just pissed Marie off that much more.
Well, probably especially because he's taking her to football games and she's like, no, girly girl, you don't go to football. So
yeah, take me out shopping. So from the time to time, Frank worried about his wife. Sometimes she would be awake all night and he would hold her while she shook in nameless fear. She was restless and was unable to soothe her. She taunted him with love letters she said that she had received from local men.
That's weird.
So, and then, of course, there's her spending, right? So this poor guy just seems like he doesn't have a backbone. It can't just be like, hey, bitch.
Well, that's part of the problem with the 50s, too, is that you just married whoever was close by and stuck with it. Whether you were happy or not.
No divorce.
That's where you were.
Yeah.
Like, the girl next door, she's kind of pretty, because you don't know what else is out there. So you're like, screw it, good enough.
Yeah, she's good enough. I'll take her. So, but then there was also Marie's spending. So, her taste kept the bill coming to the Hilly house year after year. Sometimes Frank would reprimand her, but it didn't really do any good. She wanted the best, and she wanted it now. She actually ended up renting a post office box and having some bills routed there so Frank wouldn't know what she was spending. So, and then, bitch began taking
out. That always ends well.
So, in Anniston, a town of less than 30,000 people, Frank Hilly was respected, and businesses extended credit to him, to his wife, out of courtesy. And Frank always paid his bills on time, so when his wife's accounts came past due, creditors took notice. And that just wasn't like Frank. So then, by the fall of 1974, Frank couldn't ignore the troubles in his home any longer. Word of his wife's credit arrangements leaked back to him through the grapevine. Worse still, he came home sick from work on one day to find Marie in bed with her employer.
See, I called it.
Yep. So she
sorry for ruining that.
Had a little fun time with her bosses, and they were giving her money for that as well.
Well, now that's just flat out prostitution. You don't get paid for it. It's one thing to sleep with your boss and just be a terrible person like that. Don't take money for it.
Exactly. That's sex work.
That's a whole nother crime.
So then Frank, like, he was devastated and disgusted with his wife's behavior, but he didn't really feel like he could do anything about it. So he told his son, Mark, who was married by now and attending Atlanta Christian College, of these latest developments.
No.
He didn't mention, though.
I'm sorry, but you don't get the kids involved.
Right. And, like, his grown children.
It's your marriage. It's your problems. You don't need to be getting your kids involved. I don't care if they're grown. But whatever.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, that's what I'm saying. Like, the kids are grown. Like, they have their own lives. Like, this kid, the son, is attending college. Like,
he doesn't really need to be hearing about his mom is in bed with another man. That's not, that has nothing to do with him.
Uh-uh. So, although, while Frank told his son about that stuff, he didn't mention his increasingly failing health. Oh, okay, so we're getting to it. So Frank was sick a lot during 1974, At first, he attributed his weariness and periodic bouts of nausea and vomiting to something he'd eaten or to exposure to chemicals at the foundry. He took Alka-Seltzer and bore his symptoms at best he could, but the illness persisted, and by May of 1975, he was ready to consult a doctor. So, the family physician first prescribed fluids, then kaopectate, and Maalox? Something like that. Which was an antispasmodic medication. And nothing helped. When Frank's sister, Frida, visited them on May 22nd, he told her that he was sicker than he'd ever been, and he feared that he would die. He also told her that if Marie had on Dr. Jones... He also told her that Marie had, on Dr. Jones's orders, given him an injection. And at the time, the sister didn't think anything.
Man, I totally figured it out, but I'm not saying anything. Fuck her.
But wait, it gets even fucking crazier.
I'm just listening.
Dude.
I'm not interrupting, but yeah, fuck her.
So, I totally agree. So, at 3:30 the following morning, Marie found Frank wandering the yard in his underwear. She took him to the hospital, where tests showed that his liver had failed. Dr. Jones changed his diagnosis to one of infectious hepatitis and prescribed new medication.
Okay, wait, just as a side note, if your liver fails, does that mess with your brain and make you wander around in your underwear in the front yard?
I think that if it was so bad, it probably could cause some type of toxicity. But again, I'm just like guessing.
Neither of us are doctors, just in case anyone was confused, but...
Because I always think of, like, the liver and kidneys as, like, the thing, right? And, like, maybe if they're not working, there's, like, a backup of, like, shit in your body.
And it goes into your brain? Okay, maybe.
I don't know.
The human body is a mystery to me. I have no idea.
That's Donna's diagnosis. So he still worsened, though. He was jaundiced, he was hallucinating, and he was very agitated. It was all that Mike, the son, could do to keep his father from jumping out the window. So, at around 4 a.m. on the 25th, Mike left the hospital to pick up his grandmothers and bring them to see Frank. When he returned, about an hour later, he found his mother asleep and his father dead. So, the official cause of death was infectious hepatitis, and he was buried on May 27th, 1975. The son preached a sermon at his father's funeral, and Audrey had secretly taken out a life insurance policy at the time of Frank's initial illness and redeemed this for $31,140.
Oh, the 70s. No autopsy. Life insurance policy? That's convenient. Here's your money.
Well, they did do an autopsy, but the findings...
But it's the 70s, so it wasn't as advanced. Yeah.
Yeah. And those findings at that time supported the hepatitis diagnosis. So she completely gets away with this one. So then, 3 years later, she takes out a life insurance policy worth $25,000.
Oh, no.
Carol.
You suck.
She sucks. With an accidental death clause that took effect in August of 1978... So
why is there an accidental death clause in your life insurance policies? That's just asking for it.
Oh
no, it was an accident. No, that is not a clause that should exist.
No. So then she began experiencing trouble with nausea, and she was admitted to the emergency room several times. A year after filing the insurance policy on Carol, Audrey gave Carol an injection she said would alleviate the nausea. But, of course, Carol's symptoms only became worse, resulting in numbness of her extremities. Testing found no reason for Carol's illness and feared the symptoms were psychosomatic. Because she's a lady. She's like, what's going on?
You're just imagining it, sweetheart.
So Carol then... Yeah. It's all in your head. So
yeah, lay down and let me masturbate you. It'll get rid of the demons.
It'll be all good. Oh, God. In my women's studies class last term, there were girls in there that didn't know that that was a thing. I'd like to watch their faces as they learn that. It's just great. Oh, it was just like, you're going to learn some things, lady. Okay. So, she underwent psychiatric testing at Birmingham's Caraway Methodist Hospital. And while she was there, she received 2 more injections from her mother.
If she's at another hospital, why are they still letting her mother inject her with stuff? Quit it!
She's doing it secret because she's telling the daughter, don't tell anyone. So then, a month after she's admitted to the hospital, her physician said that she was suffering from malnutrition and vitamin deficiencies, adding that they suspected heavy metal poisoning was to blame for the symptoms.
Figure some shit out.
Right. So fucking finally... So at this point, Audrey fucking panics and knows that she's about to get called out on her shit. And so she has Carol discharged from that hospital that afternoon. But she didn't stay out of the hospital for long. And the following day, she was admitted to the University of Alabama Hospital. Oh, and then finally, Carol catches a break. And Audrey is arrested for passing bad checks. Which out of like
all that's kind of funny, yeah.
For, it's the bad checks.
It's like Al Capone going to jail for tax evasion.
Right. So, and the checks were written to the insurance policy that insured Carol's life, so that policy
collapsed.
Right. So karma's getting this lady. And then doctors began to focus their efforts on the possibility of heavy metal poisoning, noting that Carol's hands and feet were numb, she had nerve palsy causing foot drop, which I looked up and it's like a gait abnormality that's super complicated to explain. It seems like the muscles in your foot like drop.
Okay.
And then she had also lost most of her deep tendon reflexes. So then, like icing on the cake, the doctors noticed those, I'm going to say it wrong, those Aldrich Meese lines. The white lines of discoloration on Carol's nails that indicate. So finally getting the drift, the doctors conducted tests on samples of Carol's hair on October 3rd, 1979 at the Alabama Department of Forensic Sciences. Those tests revealed arsenic levels ranging from over 100 times the normal level close to the scalp to 0 times the normal level at the end of the hair shaft. So, of course, that proved that she'd been giving increasingly larger doses of arsenic over a period of 4
Just die already! Yeah.
And then that same day, Frank's body was exhumed, so the dead husband, and upon examination showed between 10 and 100 times the normal level
of arsenic. Fuck you, bitch.
Right. She's getting it. So obviously, it was concluded that Audrey was poisoning the shit out of both of them, causing Frank's death. 3 days after the exhumation and tests on Carol, Frank's sister found an empty medicine vial in a cosmetic case among Audrey's belongings that were stored at her mother-in-law's home. And then, so that vial was turned over to the police and revealed traces of arsenic. And then, so, fucking our bitch is still in... She's still incarcerated on her bad check charges when she was arrested on October 9th for the attempted murder of her daughter. The police found another vial in her purse, which was revealed to have the presence of arsenic. Which, like, how fucking
right
are you? Like, keep the evidence out of your handbag.
But how else was she going to inject her daughter in the hospital? Of course it's in her purse. She's taking it with her everywhere.
But it's like...
It's an opportunistic poisoning.
She was real smart. She put it... Not that I, like, want to poison anyone, but lady, like, put it in your lady pocket. If you put it in your vagina, no one's going to find it.
Your prison purse.
Yeah, anytime you really want to hide something, that's where you put it.
I'm pretty sure that they check your orifices when they check you into prison.
I'm sure they do.
Because of people hiding shit in their prison pocket.
Yeah. So, 2 weeks later, Frank's sister found a jar of Crowley's new and improved rat poison, which contained 1.4 to 1.5% arsenic. But then, on November 9th, Audrey's released on...
Why? Who put the money up for that?
Do not understand.
She was bouncing checks. It's not like she could afford her own bail. Who put the money up for that?
Right, so And that I couldn't find out. Like, it just said she's released on bail.
What the fuck?
And also, it's just like, I mean, granted, at this point, it's the 70s. So they're just like, okay, yeah. Lady, are you really that dangerous? You know, yeah. Let her go.
We live in a pre-Eileen Wuornos world at that point. They don't know.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, she goes and she registers at a local motel under an assumed name. And she straight disappears. Mm-hmm. A note was left behind indicating that she might have been kidnapped.
Yeah.
Like, she wasn't.
Yeah, okay, sure.
So then, she might have been kidnapped.
What the fuck ever. If you're gonna, like, set it up so it looks like you were kidnapped, you were kidnapped in your note. You know what I'm saying?
You were kidnapped.
Maybe.
I was possibly kidnapped. What the fuck? So then, they file a missing persons report, and she's listed as a fugitive. And so now, she's on the run. On November 19th, there was a break-in at the home of her aunt. A car, some women's clothing, and an overnight bag were missing from the home. Investigators found a note in the house reading, "Do not call the police. We will burn you out if we do. We found what we wanted, and we will not bother you again."
All they wanted was some ladies' clothes and a handbag. Oh, and a car. Okay, that's fair. But still, that's not very much.
The car's important. No, not
so
at all. So, the scribbled message left behind at the hotel led investigators to believe that she intended to start anew, where she changes her personality to fit her surroundings. And then, so, one of the FBI agents said that, of Audrey, she could be kind, laughing, considerate, and then brutal and hateful. We believe she is living in a world with make-believe friends and enemies. When she reads this, if it's the real Audrey Hilly, she will probably change her personality when she realizes what she is accused of doing. So, lady was a chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
So then, on January 11th, 1980, she was indicted in absentia for her husband's murder. Subsequently, investigators found that both her mother and her mother-in-law, Carrie, the one who used to watch the kids, and the mother-in-law had died 2 years after Frank, had significant but not fatal traces of arsenic in their system
when
they died. And then also, the remains of Sonia Marcel Gibson, an 11-year-old friend of Carol Hilly's, who had died of undetermined causes in 1974, was also exhumed and examined, but was found to only contain a normal amount of arsenic.
Well, yeah.
So this little girl, Gibson.
Sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No. So. Well, she was one of the many neighborhood children who had fallen ill after drinking beverages that they had been giving during visits to the Hilly household.
But, like, why would she try and poison children? I mean, I understand, like, in her brain, why she's poisoning the other people for the money. I don't understand why she would poison the neighborhood children intentionally.
Well, no, that just seems like she's a poisoner, right?
Yeah.
She poisons everyone, and there is no motive.
But she has motive for the other ones, so I don't.
Exactly.
The kids don't make sense to me. I understand why they didn't actually find anything on them, because that's kind of grasping.
And then they also said that two police officers who had been dispatched to look into a disturbance that Audrey Hilly had called 911 about also reported coming down with nausea and stomach cramps after drinking coffee that Audrey had served them.
That I would get.
So, yeah, I would get that too. But yeah, I don't, like, why would she kill her daughter's friends? That doesn't make any sense. But then sometimes people just do shit to do it.
That's true.
So who the fuck knows? So, despite a massive manhunt coordinated by the police and the FBI, she remained a fugitive for a little more than 3 years, which is where the story gets shit.
We weren't there yet.
So, no. So then, Audrey traveled to Florida, where she met a man named John Greenleaf Homan III, using the name Robbie Hannon. They lived together for more than a year before she married him in 1981 and took his last name. So then, that couple, now they moved to New Hampshire. And then, fucking lady invents a twin sister for her.
Why?
Says the twin sister's name is Terry, wait for it, and alleges that the twin sister, who doesn't exist, lives in Texas.
Oh my god.
So then, and this does not sound...
No! Familiar. This is nuts!
Still. Okay, so late in the summer of 1982, she left New Hampshire telling her now husband that she needed to attend to family business and see some doctors about an illness, which just seems strange to me, because it was like, if she's sick and he's her husband, like, wouldn't he want to accompany her?
You would think, but who the hell knows?
Who knows? So then, during this time, she traveled to Texas and Florida using the alias Terry Martin, which is the name that she gave her twin sister.
Oh my God.
So during the trip, posing as Terry, she called John Homan, her husband, and informed him that Robbie Homan had died in Texas, but there was no need for him to go to Texas as the body had been donated to medical science.
What the fuck?
Right? Which is exactly what I wrote. I wrote, what the fuck? Oh, your wife died, but you can just stay with...
Yeah, just don't worry about it. It's not a problem.
Like, that seems like a huge flashing neon sign that some fucked up...
There's no way that anybody would be like, oh, don't worry about your wife. It's cool. She's dead. Just stay put. You're fine.
Right. If, like, Nate's brother called me and was like, hey, Nate's dead. Don't worry about it. I'd be like,
even though you've actually met his brother and you know he's real and that he exists. This is a whole nother thing. This is a sibling you've never met.
Right, that's a whole other thing. That's just so crazy to me that he's just like,
what the hell?
So then on November 12th or 13th, after changing her hair color and losing weight.
This is some Gone Girl shit.
To New Hampshire. It's crazy. So she, like, changes her color, hair color, loses some weight, and she goes back to New Hampshire and meets her fucking husband posing as the fake twin
sister. Oh my God.
Of the deceased wife. Okay. So then she begins living with...
Why?
Him again.
You were already doing that. You don't need to do it again as a different person.
I know. It's like, you think she's already in the clear. I mean, she's already, like, escaped from prison. She's going by this new name. She got married, so her last name is even more...
This
different.
Is too elaborate. It's... Calm like, down.
What are you doing? So then, we're almost at the end. So, an obituary for Robbie Homan appeared in the New Hampshire newspaper, but aroused suspicion when police were unable to verify the information.
Yeah, no shit.
A New Hampshire state... Yeah, like, they're like, this person doesn't fucking exist. So then, a New Hampshire state police detective gets this, like, huge light bulb moment and realizes the woman living as Terry Martin was, in fact, Robbie Homan, and had staged her death.
Which, like, yeah, no shit. Why would...
They...
Sorry, I'm still stuck on why. Why was this necessary?
Why would you do that?
If you're, like, just going to come back to the same husband, don't bother. You don't have to leave in the first place.
Right,
you're set.
Just go away. So then they bring her in, and she breaks down, and she confesses to being Audrey Marie Hilly. And then so they have her return to Alabama to face trial. And so the revelation came as a shock to her new husband.
Yeah, no shit.
Oh,
that
God.
Poor dude thinks his wife is dead.
Dude. She's so good at it. She's so good at fooling these guys. Because she... There's a quote now by her husband, the John Homan guy, who says, if I were taken to court today, I could swear they were two different people if she hadn't told
me. Jesus Christ.
He said, this has not changed my feelings about her at all. I don't believe after living with that woman that there is a mean bone in her
body. What the fuck ever?
Which I'm just like,
regardless of mean, she's fucking
so
nuts.
Times.
There is a screw loose
like,
up there.
She doesn't even know, I think, at this point about the murders. So then she's obviously quickly convicted, and she's sentenced to life in prison for her husband's murder, and then 20 years for the attempted murder of her daughter. And then so she begins serving her sentence in 1983 and was said to be a quiet model prisoner. And then the good behavior earns her several one-day passes from prison. But at that time, she always returned on time at that time. But again, why are you giving this fucking lady
passes?
She's
a nut.
Like, she's already escaped from prison.
I'm not giving Ted Bundy day passes to get out of prison and go wander around if he wants.
Fuck. Oh, my God.
If someone's a runner, don't do it.
Right. Doesn't make any sense. So then in February of 1987, so she's been in jail for a little bit now, she escaped after she was given a 3-day pass to visit her husband,
John Why Coleman. Would you stay married?
When I read that, I was like, what the fuck? Like, he finds out his wife isn't who she says in the first place, and then she disappears and fakes her own death, introduces himself as the deceased wife's sister, and it's like, what the Why? Crap?
Well, that, and technically speaking, they're not even legally married at that point, because he married a woman that never existed.
Exactly.
Fuck.
So then, and the husband, John, had actually moved to Anniston to be closer to his wife. So they spent a day at the Anniston Motel, and when John left for a few hours, bitch disappeared.
I think John got hit in the head at some point when he was a kid. That dude is not very smart. He's making poor choices.
That's not, like, God. So, and then she leaves a note behind asking John for his...
Oh, I thought he was going to say kidnapped again.
Maybe I was kidnapped.
Just kidnapped? ?
Is that what happened? So then, of course, the people that were connected to the case were livid that a convicted murderer and accomplished escape artist would be given a prison furlough. So I think at this point, they actually, like, went back and, like, re-looked at all their furlough procedures and, like, tried to change things. And then, so the assistant district attorney who prosecuted Audrey said, I think this is not just insane, it's gross negligence. Which, like, yeah.
Well, why are people being let out of prison on day passes anyways? Why is that a thing?
I didn't even know that was a thing. But then, this time, she doesn't fare so well.
Thank God.
So only 4 days go by when she vanished from the hotel, and Anniston police responded to a call about a suspicious person, went to a home, and found her. So she apparently had been crawling around in the woods, drenched by 4 days of frequent rain, and numb from overnight temperatures in the low 30s. So she was taken to a local hospital and underwent emergency treatment for hypothermia. But while she was there, she suffered a heart attack and died.
Serves her right.
So, but then, like, this is the best quote, I think, about, like, how to end this whole case. Because, like, this is so crazy. But so the Calhoun County District Attorney, Bob Field, said, it seems to be an anticlimactic way for someone who was the great escape artist to die. This goes against everything she's done in the past. The biggest escape artist in this area in 10 years, and what does she do? She ended up crawling around in the woods.
Yeah.
And, like, they still don't have, like, a true motive, other than the money, for why she did everything that she did.
Well, yeah, it's just the money. She's just a greedy asshole.
Yeah. But, like, the shit about, like, God, like, why did, after she was in the
car, that's,
you know, if she had just stayed Robbie Cannon, married to that dude, she would have been fine. Then,
again, if you're gonna take off, why come back as the sister? Like, the dude thinks his wife is dead. After, you're good. Bail on to the next life.
Absolute no sense to me. It was like, you have to wonder, like, what, also, like, emotionally, like,
yeah.
You know, you never want to, like, label people, but does she have some type of, like, you know, is she a sociopath, or she, like, doesn't identify with other people, or, like, does she still need that, like, human connection, and that's why she went back to the husband?
I don't fucking know.
Like, what the
fuck? There's just, like, a whole box of screws up there. All of them are loose.
Yeah. I know.
Fuck, that's a good one.
But, yeah, that was the one
That is a good one. That is nuts.
This week, I don't think we need a man murdering a woman. So I was like, let's pick a lady poisoner.
A lady nutball. God. That's just nuts. No. Some soap opera shit. That was good. Thank you.
Fine. Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay, well, if you want to find us online, we are on Instagram and Twitter at Serial Sisters, and our email is serialsisters@outlook.com. Thanks.
Thanks.